Okay, so let's wrap up this sugya. So obviously we won't read through the whole article here, but I thought that Benny Brown did a good job summarizing the issues, framing them in economic theory enough to sort of wrap up the issues that we've been talking about. So okay, so let's talk about it outside and sort of bring together everything that we've seen in the last week and a half or so, or depending on how much of the sugya you think is part of it, 2 weeks, I don't know. Okay, so first point. Everybody more or less agrees that our sugya provides the possibility of some sort of labor union, meaning the power invested in a certain profession to make a group, make agreements for that group that are binding. Okay, that much is basically a given in our sugya. Now, Brown makes the very fair point, which is that is not exactly the point of unions in modern society, right? There's a fundamental difference, which is that in the context, in the sugya, it's pretty clear that the laws were there to protect the people from each other. Right? That was the main point of these guilds in the Gemara. Right? The whole discussion is, I take Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, you take whatever, right? Or Sunday, Tuesday, Thursday, you take Monday, Wednesday, Friday, if you take my day, then I rip up your, right? Then I rip up the leather from your shechita. But it's meant to protect each other. It's not there to act as a bargaining chip against employers. It's not there to protect them from the outside. In fact, as we saw in the Meiri, the extent to which the decisions of the guild affect people on the outside, the less legitimate we think their power is. Right? The more that your decisions aren't just regulating trade within, but are impacting prices in the community and things like that, and that's where you don't have power all by yourself, because you're no longer the only relevant parties. So on the one hand, it is clear that our sugya provides the basis for some sort of unionization, some side of creation of a guild with rules that bind, but it's also clear that you've got to make some conceptual jumps to get to unions in the modern sense, where their primary role is not just to regulate, right? It's not just to regulate internally, right? It's not just to say, these are the days you work, this is the measurements that we use, this is the quality that is expected, but it's to negotiate with employers, it's to set expectations of labor hours and safety and things like that that are aimed at the outside, those outside the guild, rather than those inside. Okay? So it is clear that as much as our sugya provides the basis for this bottom-up power structure, whether you think it's contractual or whether you think it's sort of a microcosmic political institution, it's still not the same. Okay? With that background, He notes, let's go through it, right? You've read it. But let's talk it out, and hopefully by the end we'll have summarized many of the issues, and both in the sugya and see how they play out in halacha, okay? In general, as I was telling Yonatan before, Benny Brown he's excellent in general. Everything he writes is worth reading. Whether or not you agree with everything he says, he's a very, very careful scholar, very, very well read. In law and philosophy and economic theory, his articles, he's written basically about the Haredi world for the last 200 years. That's basically his emphasis. So he has a series of articles about the Chafetz Chaim and the approach of the Chafetz Chaim to basically turn ethical halachot into law, right? And the cost that he sees that came from that sort of systematic approach of the Chafetz Chaim. He wrote a 1,000-page, 2-volume biography of the Chazon Ish. He's written a 120 pages, if I remember, historical, intellectual history of Das Torah through the ages and how we got to the point we did in four. I think he divides it into like four historical epics in the last 150 years, how we got here. He's a very, very fascinating thinker. This particular article is just, you know, available on his academia.edu page. So, you know, you can get it for free. I didn't steal it, and, you know, I also didn't have to go and, like, copy each page, which you can tell from the fact that it's, like, you know, printed normally. Okay. So he tries to summarize, and he notes that economic theories, right, economics was the order of the day in the last, let's say, right, last few hundred years. Economic theories and the questions of how employees and employers relate and economic structures. You know, so much of that has changed in the last few hundred years. And that eventually led to, right, the creation of unions in the context where most of these machlokot happen, right? And the big, right, the real machlokot were in the 50s. And that's why you see the post going writing there, Moshe Feinstein, Mishpat Uziel. So again, who are these people? Rav Uziel was the first Sephardi chief rabbi of Israel, Rav Ben Sion Meir Chai Uziel. It's a long name. Rav Moshe Feinstein, who obviously was a leading posek in the United States. A little bit Rav Kook, who was the first rabbi of the mandate. Right, he was pre-state. He died before the state. Rav Hershenson, who is a fascinating thinker, who was the rabbi of Kehila Kedosha de Hoboken. He was the rabbi of Hoboken, fascinating thinker. When he moved Europe to Israel, then to America, he writes. He's one of the earliest people to write about democracy and all types of interesting things. He has all types of controversial halachic positions that lead him to be rejected by many poskim. He's a very interesting thinker. But that's really when this comes to the fore in the 50s. Okay? There are some discussions before, and that's what he notes. That there were some books that were being written before about labor theory in halacha, but it came to a halachic. It really came to a halachic fore in the 50s when people started striking, which is, you know, a national pastime in this country. You know, as much as people strike in America, in Israel, it's like, it's a hobby. In Israel, like, not only do you have strikes, you have these amazing, like, strike deals, where if a particular profession can't strike because they're essential, they'll just make a deal with another union that will strike on their behalf. So, like, you know, if, like, the police can't strike, they'll make a deal with, like, I don't know, teachers who will, whatever. What? They like the different histad, right?
Is the model here like the American one, or is it like the
fascist one? Oh, we've had different models, and we have a holdover from the very socialist years in Israel, where strikes are very still very popular. In Canada also. In Canada, they're even more popular. Canada, there is not, basically not a graduating class who in the universities who has not had at least one strike during their, like, Ura had like a 4-month strike when she was in York. Like, you know, people get a lot of learning done during these strikes, but yeah. Well, let's get there. I don't know if all of them have thought it out so much, right? I don't know. It's just the way. It's just the way this country works. I don't know. There are always strikes of some sort. I don't know. There are always strikes. When I made Aliyah, there was a strike of the far of the Misrad Hachutz. So you couldn't do anything at any of the embassies anywhere in the world. But, like, it was very planned. Like, you know, they told you in advance, we will be striking on this day, we'll be back at work, you know, like, it's very... Yeah, what? What? Yeah, yeah. So, like, in order to make Aliyah, you had to come to Israel and file. Normally, you file in you know, before you come as a citizen. But here, the Misrad HaPnim has to make up for it. So, but you can only go to the Interior Ministry in the country. So they took you to a special place in the airport where they processed all the things that you couldn't process in Israel, so that the same paperwork could be done. But this time, it was a mess. But the country just likes doing these things. Fine. So what Brown does that I want to point out, other people have written about this as well. So, you know, here he summarizes Rav Moshe, Rav Uziel, Rav Cook, Rav Hershenson. But there were, Lord Jakubowicz also wrote about this. Do you guys know who Lord Jakubowicz is? He was Rabbi Sachs's, what?
Chief Rabbi of England.
Yeah, he was Rabbi Sachs's predecessor as Chief Rabbi of England. He was also made Lord Baron Jakubowicz. So he has an article on it. There's an excellent chapter also in if you're interested in like sugyos in economics. There's an excellent excellent book called By the Sweat of Your Brow by Professor Schnall, who from YU, who has there's a bunch of Schnalls in YU. It's the father. I forget his first name. Whatever. Who has an excellent book where he has one chapter on labor unions, he has one chapter on whatever. In general, the king of economic theory in Torah was Rabbi Dr. Aaron Levine, who wrote like at least ten books on economic theory and Jewish law. I've been trying to get as a guest speaker one of the Rebbeim at YU who wrote his thesis under Rabbi Levine on unions. So if we do, then he can follow up on this issue. We'll see. I've been working on it. It's been... Jonathan Cohen has not yet successfully gotten a hold of him, so... But anyway, so Brown notes that basically the models of labor of regulation of labor relations that emerged in these modern ideologies set the background for the disputes that were going to arise in Israel. And he argues that you can understand the different halachic positions that were developed in light of these different theories, that essentially, consciously unconsciously, these poskim were providing models that could be mapped onto the ideologies of the day. Right? That's basically his central thesis. So what are the three models that he outlined? Yes, Rami. The three economic models that he starts with as his introduction. What? Liberalism, communism, and fascism. Right. Those are the three that he picks. Right. So how does he understand these three? Right. For our purposes. Right. So he says communism. What in terms of regulation of labor? What's its ultimate goal? Correct. Abolition of classes, because the whole world is divided into employees and employers, which, you know, Yonatan and I talked about for a while, why halacha doesn't really believe this, simply because halacha doesn't have those sweeping models, right? It just believes that an employee is a person doing a job and an employer is a person paying them to do that job, right? And therefore, in halacha, you know, as I said, if I, you know, work for Migdal, but I also hire a handyman, then on that day I am both an employer and an employee. So to say that I am part of a class of employer or employee in halacha just makes no sense, because it's just determined by, you know, my position in any particular agreement. But fine, communism fundamentally views the world as employers and employees, and it wants the abolition of this. So theoretically, in an utopian world, there should be no conflict with employers, because there will be no employers, no need to negotiate, right, etc., right? No need to regulate. What? Well, that was part of what Yonatan was saying, was shouldn't halacha embrace this model because in theory there'll be no conflict? And I was like, give it, there will be conflict. Right? It's very nice, like, you know, again, I quoted at him Rice Sachs, who, you know, right, Rice Sachs' summary of the world is that the world is being torn apart by, right, the extreme right, the extreme left, the extremely extreme religious, right, the fundamentalist religious and the extreme atheists, right? But his summary of the right and left was it's being torn apart by the extreme right, who want to return to a glory that never was, and the extreme left who want to pursue a utopia that never will be, right? Halacha is not like, halacha is much more real than that, right? Because yes, of course there'll be conflict, right? Okay, but that's how he talks about communism, and the other two models that he sets up are liberalism and fascism, right? And for our purposes, what does he mean by liberalism and fascism? Yes, Ezra.
So, the liberalism model is based off of like collective bargaining, so whatever agreement is reached between like between the employer and the employees as a group is whatever.
Right. So, for the way he lays out the liberal position here, is that the solution to the plight of workers is simply free unionization. It's basically the right of employees to get together and make whatever deals they want with employers, right? It's basically the model where strength comes from your negotiation, right? As groups, as individuals, however you choose to do it, right? That's the model that liberalism would believe in, right? That's the model he proposes that he calls liberalism for this. And again, it doesn't interest me so much if you want to agree with every assessment of what he's saying these models are. He sets up three models, right? Which, for our purpose, is what we're going to work with, right? And then fascism, how does he present fascism here, yeah? You already said it. Someone else, Ellie, go. Right, so the way he sets it up is that harmony can only be achieved through the intervention of a third party in the relationship between the employee and the employer. In the case of fascism, it was the state. Right, so basically he sets up three models, right? The communist model in which there are no employees, employers. The liberal model in which it should all be based on negotiation, free negotiation, and the fascist model that thinks that these decisions require a third party. Right? Those are the three ideologies that he thinks are floating around in the world about how to regulate labor. Okay, then he gives you a bit of a historical perspective, and he notes that the early settlers of Israel were, many of them were members of the radical left, socialist groups, and obviously ideally wanted a full communist society where this would not be relevant, as you saw in many of the early kibbutzim, right? The secular, especially the secular kibbutzim. And that obviously has a lot of, or that utopian world had a lot of influence in early Israel. But obviously which major American politician is influenced by his time on an old school kibbutz? Is Bernie Sanders, right? Right. Sanders spent time in an old school kibbutz, right? His experience of Israel is very much in line with the vision that he has, right? Which is this utopian model, which maybe worked at some level in the small kibbutzim, though there were plenty of problems in the kibbutzim. Look, the original kibbutzim were really, really extreme, right? We know it's not just the economics, right? You didn't have family units, right? You weren't allowed to have your kids live with you in your house. They had to live in the children house, right? The children were taken care of by society as a whole. That was one of those things that went eventually, even in the more extreme of the kibbutzim that exist. Not many of them exist anymore, but definitely not in that sense. Almost none of them have the family house thing. What? I don't know. It could be. I don't know. I don't know. I know most of them do not. I don't know if all of them do not. Then he notes that there were the corporatist model, right, which for him is right equivalent to the fascist model in this sense, right? Just the idea that there is this third party, and he notes he claims that Jabotinsky represented this, right? Zev Jabotinsky, who was the father of the revisionist movement, the Rebbe, so to speak, of Menachem Begin. And he notes that in his article Histadrut HaUvdim HaLeumit, he wrote that the principle of arbitration is the fundamental principle for the success of our settlement enterprise. We will not let anyone forget it, nor adulterate it, or falsify it. He saw this method as balancing between the interests of workers and the interests of the bourgeoisie and the middle class, whom he cherished. Right? That's his sort of historical summary of this. And then the liberal model he saw as adopted by the Tzionim Klalim, the general Zionists, which espoused a liberal capitalist view, encouraged free economy, etc. Okay, right, that's his sort of historical background to prove that these ideas are floating around in early Israel when the major halachic disputes arise. Okay, fine. So now let's talk halacha. With that background, let's talk halacha. So again, as we already mentioned, it's clear that the main source on this sugya is Bava Basra, Ted Amon Aleph. Right, 100% the sugya of the guilds of the Shochtim. Yes, we all agreed. The Shochtim set deals, can punish. Right, that's the main sugya from which we know that fundamentally the notion of a guild is plausible within halacha. Yeah? You're all with me? Again, as he notes here on page 90, that halacha realized, of course, the existence of conflicts between employees and employers, but the discussion of these cases were almost always in private discourse, without reference to collective confrontations, right? Meaning, the cases in our sugyas are not employees versus employers, they're the guild members amongst each other. So therefore, it doesn't necessarily provide insight into labor in the way that it's being talked about in the 19th and 20th centuries. Yes? And not really, meaning they're independent. They just made a deal between each other. That's the definition of a guild, right? Like, they're both independent. They don't work for each other. They just, right, they have to follow the... Again, right, meaning if different lawyers have to follow the rules of the bar, that doesn't mean they work for each other. It just means that they're bound by common, right, by common standards. That is really a stretch. Come on. Meaning, again, right, like, that's not how these things work, right? Even if you set up certain competition laws built into your code of ethics of the profession, that doesn't mean you work for each other. It just means that you've agreed to follow certain standards. Okay, well, that we talked about in the sugya is, are we talking about all, most, right? We talked about that, and we started talking about that. Is it everyone? Do you need representation of everybody, etc.? That's why that's relevant. But he notes that despite the differences, starting in the 19th century, you start this, you know, you have this discussion. So he notes that you have a minor Polish posseg of Arya Leibush Lifshitz in 1874, who starts writing about Shochtim striking, where he opposes strikes. Then you get Rav Hershenson in 1923, where he doesn't seem to think that strikes are problematic halakhically, but he doesn't like it. He thinks it's immoral, right? It's not pietistic, at least, to engage in strikes. But again, they're talking about strikes, but they aren't really getting into, right, the whole system of unionization, using the power of the union to get what you want through strikes and things like that, right? That doesn't really appear until you get to the 20th century. Yeah.
This is like a question, but also, yeah. Does this apply
Once there's a non-Jew involved, it gets complicated because you have to start bringing Din of the Malchutza and things like that. Correct, so then that changes the equation, obviously. Okay, now Brown makes the argument that the reason that there isn't so much discussion about this type of labor organization before the 20th century, so he makes two claims. He notes a bunch of people who are pretty cynical who basically say the reason there was no discussion of this was that rabbis always sided with the rich people. I don't like that. I don't think that... Brown's own claim, which is that this only really becomes relevant, as we talked about yesterday, once the kehilah, right, collapses, makes a lot more sense to me. Meaning, when the government, when the Jews ran their own societies politically, right, so there were rules in place, right. It took a while for things to collapse and reorganize, where the organizational principle was unions and things like that. That makes a lot more sense. That's why you don't find early discussions, because you saw plenty of discussions in that Pischei Tshuva on labor laws and things like that, but they're all in the context of Tihilo. They're not in, right, workers versus employer in the same way, just because that wasn't the way it was. I mean, I don't know. It was organized by the Kihila, however it was organized. But then in the 1930s, you really get the poskim talking about labor law per se, and there were many, many books being written there, right? You have, and he quotes several of them, by Baruch Schlichter and Ramosha Feindling, Vichule. Okay, Sof. Now, with all that background, let's get to the specific way it plays out in terms of unions, and the major question that everyone asked when it came to unions was striking, right? This is basically how all the 50s, Tshuvos in the 50s, are all dealing with these two questions simultaneously, right? Which is, can you unionize, and if you unionize, can you use strikes? So the first major Tshuva that really, really deals with these issues that people are invoking is by Rav Kook, right? It's a short oral tshuva in 1933, but it gets brought into the discussion in the 50s, okay? So, Rav Kook was asked about strikes. And what did Rav Kook say? Rami, what did Rav Kook say?
I think he saw it as like necessary or it was allowed.
To do what?
To express disinterest with your current working decisions.
To do what?
To
force the... But only to get your employer to the Beit Din. Right? Rav Kook is talking primarily about strikes, and he sees strikes as a legitimate way of getting this discussion to the Beit Din, right? If your employer refuses to get debates and to have a discussion and settle this in the way Halacha wants it settled, so then you can strike, but otherwise he opposes it. Good. So Brown argues that Rav Kook, in this sense, he's not yet talking about unions, but already seems to fundamentally, in the halachic version, believe in a corporative fascist model. I don't like using the word fascist because it's too charged, but corporative, right? In the sense that Rav Kook fundamentally, and remember we talked about this, how most of the sugya does seem to indicate a bottom-up approach in labor, but the existence of Adam Chashuv could just be a corrective, but could also set the model for a top-down model, right? But once you shift from guilds that are affecting each other to guilds whose goal is to negotiate and affect the rest of society, right, through employers, the more chashivut you saw in the Adam Chashuv thing, right, the more you saw that, again, think about the Meiri's model. The Meiri said, as soon as a guild starts affecting people outside the guild, then you need outside help, right, then you need the Adam Chashuv. Right? If you translate a Meiri type model into the 20th century, where the main point of unions isn't to negotiate amongst each other, but to force society, right? Or at least employers, but other people besides for the people in the guild, to act in a certain way. So then, if you see the role of Adam Chashuv as being necessary to have a top-down corrective once other people are affected besides the people in the union, Serv Kook makes a lot of sense, right? And what he says is this basically maps on to the corporative model, right? The fascist model. That once, again, I'll use corporative, which is what he does here also, because I think it's just less offensive than saying fascist. And, you know, saying that things should go to Besdin is not quite the same as, it doesn't carry the same baggage as fascism, right? And maybe you wanted to, I don't know, but I don't. And if you want to say that's because I'm a rabbi and identifying the rabbinate with fascism doesn't sit well with me, maybe that's true, I don't know. But he argues that Rav Kook is basically, right, setting up a halachic version of what would look like the corporative model, right, which is decisions should be made by a third party, specifically Torah, by Beis Din. And therefore, the extent that you recognize unions and the extent you recognize strikes as a legitimate tool in their arsenal, it has to be just to force them to get to the right third-party Torah decision-making process. But that's who should be making the decision, right? And that's how, without going through a whole sugya, Rav Kook seems to... And again, is it exact map onto our sugya? No, because of what we said, that the guilds in the sugya are protecting each other, and unions here are protecting them from the employers. But as we saw, the second you go from negotiating internal to the guild, and you start negotiating with people outside the guild, there were those Rishonim who said, now the right place to go is Torah, right, is the outside poseg, the Adam Chashuv. And therefore, in modern sort of economic talk, that's the corporative model. And you see that Rav Kook's position essentially maps on to that type of model. Okay? Rav Uziel, he argues, does the same, but Rav Uziel is much, much more detailed in his approach. Okay? If you want, by the way, to look at the full piece by Rav Uziel in the original, Mishpatei Uziel is on Svaria, so you can look at it. Okay, so Rav Uziel very much believed that it was legitimate to have labor unions, right? He looks at our sugya and he says, first of all, it is clear that you are allowed to have unions and regulate principles amongst yourselves. But what did Rav Uziel think about strikes as the tool of unions? Gavi. Yeah. What did Rav Uziel think?
They didn't quite get to that.
Okay, so who? Anyone get your... Okay, Ezra, you got your... I know it's a long article, I got it. But it's English, so if you don't finish it now, you can read it later also. Yeah, what did Rav Uziel say? Right, so like Rav Hirshenson, he doesn't seem to think it's usser, because it's hard to say it's usser, because in the end of the day, you're allowed to make agreements, so why can't you make an agreement not to work? Right? Right, but he doesn't like it. He stops short of saying it's usser, but he says it's almost breach of contract. Right? Meaning, in the end of the day, right, he notes that halacha, right, he said, we're not allowed to force you to keep working, right? That's the halacha. If you want to quit in the middle of the day, you're allowed to do that. But it's also true in halacha that if you quit in such a way that you cause loss to your employer, right? You quit at exactly the moment when it'll cause loss, the halacha is you might owe them money. So from here, Rav Uziel derived that striking is, if not usher, problematic halachically, because you have the right to negotiate, but to use the lack of work to harm financially the employer is not something that exists in halacha. And therefore he doesn't, right, he doesn't love it. Now again, Brown correctly points out that Rav Uziel is not saying it's technically usher. right? He's saying it's because Ravuzio recognizes that the modern strike is not exactly the same. And there he doesn't say usser. He just says, I see, right? It seems like the fact that we would hold a worker liable if he stopped work in such a way that it would destroy his employer's business, right? He stopped in the middle of the... Yeah, right? That, he says, it seems like that would make it usser. He stops short because it's not quite the same.
One second.
Yaakov, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, if the employer's not paying the employee as much money as he, fairly, according to the Torah, enough money to live by,
right, so here's
would it change the equation according to...
So, according to Ruziel, probably not, and the reason is because you already agreed to a price, right? You want to change it later, whether the fact that these people striking are striking because they're not being paid fairly. But the problem is in halacha, once you agreed to take a salary, right, you can't, right, I mean, you can try to negotiate later, but there isn't like an idea that once you made an agreement, you made an agreement in halacha, right? There isn't a minimum wage in that sense, right? In a formal sense. Right? That's the problem. But I think that part of the reason that Rav Uziel holds back from saying that it's usher to strike is because it doesn't exactly map on. And yeah, people sometimes strike because it's not that their halachic rights are being violated, but their moral rights are being violated. Right? And therefore, what is Rav Uziel... right? So what did Rav Uziel... Right? Rav Uziel didn't want to just leave the workers out in the cold, though. So what was Rav Uziel's suggestion? So he said he didn't love striking, but he had two points that he thought the workers should be able to use to their advantage to protect their rights. One was simply the fact that halacha incorporates more than strict law. And this comes to Yaakov's point. Is that the first is a recognition that halacha, in addition to the strict letter of the law, includes, as we saw in Din de Bar Metzra, values like Vasizi Yashvatov. And halacha tries to incorporate fairness beyond the technical letter of the law. Right? In an ideal society, that should make it that you wouldn't have to strike, because you wouldn't just be treated legally, you'd be treated fairly. But the second is that, what does Rav Uziel suggest? Ellie, what does he suggest? I don't know how far you guys got in this article. Right, so he says, you don't necessarily have to strike, but he very much encourages using other powers that emerge from unionization. So how does this play out for him? So the way he basically suggests is as follows. So turn to page 104. He writes, the rationale for this law is that no trade organization can be objective in its decisions, but only subjective, and their own self-interest blinds them from seeing the employer's point of view. Moreover, the existence of one organization leads to the establishment of another to counter it, and they both do not limit themselves to their direct interests. And so, the constant clashing between the two sides, the workers and the employers, never stops, and is followed by blind resistance and constant mutual hostility. In spirit of this understanding, he suggested to establish a distinguished court, a Beit Din, assembled of members fluent in Torah law and academics, proficient in the field of economics and societal market conditions, so they jointly enact a detailed labor legislation, afterwards appoint permanent judges to adjudicate on the basis of this legislation all the conflicts that occur between the workers concerning the proper division of fair labor among themselves, and settle disputes between the workers and employers concerning their mutual relationships. So what does Rav Uziel do? Right? What's Rav Uziel's solution? And again, it's an extrapolation from our sugya. But what's his solution? So in the language of our sugya, what is it? It's basically to look at our sugya and say that, right? What is Rav Uziel basically conceptually doing in our sugya, Andrew? Right? What's he doing? What's he doing in our sugya? He's saying our sugya definitely recognizes the right of unions, but it also says that whenever you have a union whose interests conflict with other members of society, so what's the best way of adjudicating it? Adam Chashuv. how do you map that onto the modern society? So he says, let's take that and extrapolate. A single Adam Chashuv in the modern world won't work. But basically, he says, the solution are have unions, but have a Beit Din that takes the place of a single Adam Chashuv, and that Beit Din will incorporate the needs of the unions, right, the labor, the needs of the employers, act as the Adam Chashuv to make sure that neither of them are setting up principles that unfairly put their interests above the other, and basically expand on that top-down corrective inherent in Adam Chashuv and set up a union society in which there are but they din that will negotiate the legitimate concerns of the unions representing the workers and of the employers. Again, following like we saw on the Miri, that once you're affecting other people, you need a outside party to weigh in, right? So you see how the Rav Uziel is taking a particular conceptual model that would emerge from our sugya, not directly, right? But is this attempt to balance the needs of the workers with others through the mechanism of Adam Chashuv, which, again, Brown points out, maps on very much to the corporatist model. Yes? Because the other, remember the way the Meiri put Adam Chashuv is you need an Adam Chashuv if the workers, the decision the workers make among themselves will affect the city. Right? So essentially, Rav Uziel saying something like that is that because the decisions that the workers, the employees will make affect the employers, right? The employers have to have a right also. Right? And whenever you have a conflict between the workers and somebody else, so Adam Chashuv comes in. So that's exactly his point. It's not. It's they're making rules on each other, right? They're making rules within the guild, but insofar as those rules affect, obviously, the employers, so you should have an outside party involved, which he calls the Bezdin.
But like, what would be an example of these rules? Let's say they want to raise whatever wage, that's not a rule that they're imposing on themselves.
Correct, but you could make a, right, you could try to make a rule that no one will work, right, in order to not disadvantage of us, no one will agree to work more than X number of hours per day.
Right.
Right? Like, we will all, right, we think that that's too much. So, right, we're not going to let you do that because then you would, right, we can, right, something like that.
Is there anything preventing
the court from firing? No, presumably not. Right, which is what happened in the airline strike in America. Right? In the 80s, right? It was Reagan, he just fired them all. Right, it's like, yes, the union can negotiate for the union, but I can just fire everybody and then hire other people. Yeah, you can do that. Yes? And Rav Kook just didn't flesh it out. Rav Kook has like an oral, short oral tshuva. He argues that conceptually they're very similar. Right? Rav Kook only focuses on strikes. Rav Uziel is the one who very clearly says, I believe in unions, but, right, this is what I think a union does. A union makes deals amongst the employers, but then that, and they negotiate with the employers through the mechanism of Adam Chashuv as the arbiter, right? Rav Uziel doesn't really, right? Rav Kook doesn't really spell all those details out. What? No, they don't just, they don't know that he puts them in the same camp, right? He says Rav Kook is like an early version of just like going this direction. Rav Uziel fleshes out the details more of what it would look like. Now, he does note that he thinks that part of what drives Rav Uziel is the ideological factor, what he calls the unity of the nation, and the idea of corporatism, right? That, right, Rav Uziel, right, he believes in the rights of workers and the like, but he, right, Rav Uziel, and this is true in across Rav Uziel's thinking, thinks that one of the supreme values in Torah is the unity of the nation. And therefore, for him to have warring parties without sort of the state or some sort of governing body ensuring that everyone gets along would go against Rav Uziel's approach in general. Like, you know, Rav Uziel felt this about Minhagim also. Rav Uziel felt there shouldn't be Ashkenazi Sephardi Minhagim, there should be one Minhag. Right? He was very much into this, right, you know, melting pot of Israel on all things. Yes, Ezra.
Um,
I think it would all depend, right? It would all depend on whatever, right? You know, again, this goes to the globalization question, but the extent to however you decide to organize, right? I think it would depend. If the employees that are negotiating are all in the city, then presumably it would have to be a city, right? A city government, Besdin, that would be doing it. If it's a national union, it might have to be the Besdin HaGadol.
But if you're saying that, like, you need the majority, like...
Again, I think it would depend. It depends. I think it would depend on whoever, right? Whatever group organizes, Mimela, that type of authority will have to weigh in. I don't think there's a rule. Yeah.
So, and let's say if we four of them want to unionize, that doesn't have, if we're like top, that doesn't have any power, right? And they could say that, like, okay, we're going to divide ourselves into a sub.
But he doesn't get into all these details of how many people have to join. He doesn't get into it.
So
Ramosha does.
So, if you were to say that nationally, a majority, let's say this is like a trans city company,
So again, we'd have to go back to the Sugyas and talk about, right? If it's attempting to be a national company, so then who does it need? A majority, every representation of everybody, all those things we saw.
But you have to pick one. Like, if you're saying it's is it just that whatever they decide is...
I think so. Right, meaning you can have the Modian...
Top-down power, otherwise it works.
What do you mean? If you have... What do you mean? It's the same in America, right? If something is cross state lines, right, then it has to be dealt with in federal court. But if it's not, meaning we make the decision how we organize our corporation, right? Once we make that decision, right, if everything we do is local, so then theoretically we can judge in local court. But if we are a national organization, it must be dealt at the federal level. If they joined a national organization, then they're no longer the majority, even if they're a majority in a city. But if they organized locally, then obviously everything would be... Both, yeah. Meaning, he doesn't spell it out, but I think if the workers are negotiating with their local employers, right, so then everything is dealt with locally. If it's on the national level, it's a national level. I can't speak for Ruziel. I don't know how he would work out every single prot. Okay. Ramosha, in his Shuvot, Brown suggests, follows the liberal model, right? Ramosha also very much believes that you can have unions, right? And if you have the translation here on page 108, where Moshe writes, right, in 1951 and 1954, that concerning the association of workers called unions, which make regulations, determine set prices, prevent employees from firing them, and help each other through strikes and similar means for their benefits, I do not see any shade of prohibition. On the contrary, we see, moreover, that they are allowed even to make terms contrary to set halachic laws in Bava Basra 8. According to this source, they are allowed to impose sanctions for enforcing their terms and even cause damage to a person who violates them, such as tear the animal's skin. Right? We saw this. Right? He says, from our sugya, you learn that you can make deals that have binding authority, and that's all there is to it. So what does he do with Adam Chashuv? So as we saw, many people read Adam Chashuv in a very narrow sense, which is maybe you only need Adam Chashuv when it goes against Halacha, right? That was one day that we saw, right? So Moshe adopts that and says, really, we learn from our sugya that power is supposed to be bottom up. The only time you need Adam Chashuv is if something is explicitly anti-Halachic, right? You're warranting punishing people. So fine, you need an Adam Chashuv, but fundamentally, Ramosha imagines that this is more about contract or bottom-up agreement, and he goes like the people who really read Adam Chashuv, right, who minimize it. he further notes, he follows the position like that we saw in the Yad Ramah, the Rimigash, right? That who is an Adam Chashuv? Not a rabbi, but a rabbi who is also a political leader, right? It has to be that very perfect synergy of the rabbi political leader. So there are many cases where the Adam Chashuv limitation even applies. And therefore he notes that if there are no such people, right? Because most rabbis are not getting involved in politics and economics, so then nobody fits Adam Chashuv, because there's the politicians and there's the rabbis. They're not doing each other's work, and therefore no one fits the bill of the Yad Ramah, and therefore we revert to pure bottom-up negotiations, right? And therefore, Rav Moshe says, of course you're allowed to have unions, but Rav Moshe basically seems to conceptualize this as, right, unions as contract law. Right, remember, we said in our sugya, there are those who conceptualize them as political, and those who say it's contract. Rav Moshe really seems to go in the direction that it's just agreements. And he therefore refers to them as something just like shutafut, as partnerships. Yeah. Yes. Oh, we didn't get to unanimity yet, right? We'll get to it, right? But Rav Moshe does seem to go more in the direction. Again, we saw this machloket in the Rishonim and the Acharonim, that unions, that the guilds are basically partnerships, and that's why they're binding. And therefore, Rav Moshe really downplays the relevance here of Adam Chashuv. And he basically thinks that, yeah, you can make whatever deals that that you want. Now, he, right, Rav Moshe does have to deal with some technicalities, which is the more you think about his contract, the more you might have to have a formal kinyan to make your decisions, but he thinks maybe not, because maybe since you agreed on these things for mutual compliance, right, that's enough, etc. Now, he has a problem, though, because he doesn't think that you need unanimous consent. Now, we said, you can defend not needing unanimous consent in the contract model simply by saying, once everyone agrees to be part of the union, so then, once you agree to be part of the union, then you're bound by majority rules. That's not so hard. Right? And that's basically what Rav Moshe says. But then Rav Moshe gets into a bit of a problem, which is, he wants to know whether people who are not in the union are bound by union decisions. Now here, if you take a partnership model, as we said, that doesn't seem to work. If you think it's a political model, it might work, right? It might be true that if we view you as a microcosm city, so maybe once you have most people in the profession in your group, then you can make rules even of the majority over the minority who chose not to be part of the union. Here, Rav Moshe is... right, Rav Moshe in the end does seem to think that you are allowed to do this, though Rav Moshe hesitates in his tshuva, if you read it inside, because he said, since people not in the union are not going to be protected by the union in negotiation, so it is hard to say that the union should make rules for them. So Rav Moshe does go back and forth a little bit, about this. And there, Rav Moshe really, therefore, tries to ground the right to strike here as well. Now, Brown argues that the reason Rav Moshe really is so into allowing unions with coercive powers, without the involvement of the courts, per se, and take the what he calls the liberal view, is because he really likes democracy and really hated communism. And he traces in Rav Moshe, you know, in his drashot how much he hated Marxist ideology, right? So, like, he writes here from Drash Moshe, he writes on page 113, there is a group of people of a systematic ideology of promoting evil traits, such as jealousy. Now, of course, people who like socialism will say, yes, they're called capitalists. But he says, no, no, those are Marxists. They think they will achieve their own welfare and the welfare of the world by having each person see that his neighbor not be richer than him. On these grounds, they wish to abolish private property, believing that welfare will be achieved only in a world where there is nothing to envy. Similarly, they promote the trait of lustfulness, stating that if conjugal relations should be lawless without any bond, and so is with each and every trait. Right? Basically, the way he saw socialism was equality because of jealousy. That basically, you can't imagine a world where people can have different things and be happy with that. And therefore, right, they glorify the right to be jealous and say everyone has the right to be jealous of anything they don't have. The only solution is to make it that everyone has the exact same. And therefore, no one is allowed to have anything that anybody else does not. Right? That's what he views as the theological problem with socialism, is that it believes that people fundamentally can't escape the jealousy that comes from other people having which they do not. And as opposed to democracy, which Moshe really, really liked. So Brown's basic perspective here, is this exactly mapping onto our sugya? No, right? And this is really what Brown argues, is that our sugya definitely is the springboard because it allows for agreements, right, between guilds. But the difference between the sugya and Baba Basra, which is making agreements among themselves, and the modern version of the union, which is making agreements so that you can negotiate with outsiders, right, is different enough that it forces the poskim to really take this as a parable, right, as a springboard for discussion about labor theory, but not actually directly mapped onto the sugya. And in that model, he basically says two halachic versions of, right, emerge. There's Rav Moshe, who goes much more with the contractual model, downplays, as we've seen in the sugya, the relevance of Adam Chashuv, and therefore basically argues that you're allowed to have unions, you're allowed to have strikes, because basically you can do whatever you agree to, right? And then there's Rav Kook, Rav Uziel, who he argues took the model that they learned from the case of Adam Chashuv, that when other people are involved, you need a outside party, what he calls a corporative model, and they use the Adam Chashuv as the hook to hang their hat on and say the right way to have an Adam Chashuv in the modern approach is Beis Din. Right? But I think what Brown does is it very nicely shows, and again, this is what we talked about on Thursday. Our sugya doesn't directly map on to modern cases, but it does provide the right enough fodder for the poskim to see the inspiration to talk about the economic issues of their day and provide guidance. And you see, both in Ruzia and Ramoshe, they stop short of saying Asur, Mutter, Chayev, because they do recognize at some level that they're giving halachic advice more than they're straight up paskening, right? Because it doesn't map directly onto the sugya. So that's why they really do go in that direction. Okay, this is hopefully enough to sort of wrap up the discussion, see how this might play out. In halacha, how it played out lemaisa in the 50s. I will just in 2 minutes point out that one of the complicating factors that we have not dealt with, but was really one of the most heated parts of this debate in the 50s, was what happens when the workers aren't just working, but they're working in professions where halacha dictates that once they're in that profession, they have to keep working because their work is also a mitzvah. The two examples being mechanchim, who were striking. That was the American case. And in Israel, it were doctor strikes. There, almost unanimously, the poskim are opposed. Because they say, look, it's one thing to talk about the right to unionize and strike when the only thing going on here is the conflict between labor and employers. But if you're not going to work, and now people are not going to learn Torah, right, that's on you. And they go farther, and they say, in halacha, you're not really allowed to take money to be a Rebbe. Formally, you take schar batala, right? You take money for not working in other things. So how can you say you're striking because you're not being paid enough? You're not halakhically being paid at all. And therefore, Rav Moshe is very, very opposed to this. Some, you'll find that in some of the poskim, they're like, well, really, as a last resort, Rebbeim can strike, but maybe when they're striking, they're obligated to take their Talmidim into their homes and give private shirim, even when they're striking, because they learn Torah not only as a job. So when it comes to things like that, the poskim really were not on the side of labor, because the extent that they were on the side of labor, they had to recognize that there was a right to treat it as labor. And doctors also, the poskim really didn't like medical strikes, for the same reason, which is, you're now dealing with straight up mitzvot, right? Saving lives, pikuach nefesh. It's much harder to justify, when you're doing that, striking, because now it's just not, it's not only about negotiations, it's about mitzvot. Okay, that's an overview of some of the historical, halachic, philosophical, economic theory discussions that were happening in the 50s. Again, they're inspired by our sugya, but not completely contained within it. I think I'm done with this sugya for now. Maybe I'll get a